Hello and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and today I have the pleasure of sitting down with Jonathan Silver. Jonathan's worn many hats in his career in both the public and private sector. Today, among other things, he's chair of Global Climate Council at Apollo, one of the world's largest private equity firms. He's also on the board at National Grid, a global 200 utility, and he's chairman of the Terram Labs, a sustainable packaging company. Earlier, he ran the loan program at the Department of Energy, which is basically the federal government's clean energy investment fund, and he was a COO at Tiger Management, having started his career at McKinsey. So considering the, we'll call it wild energy and climate backdrop we're looking at today, I thought a conversation with Jonathan would be very timely as we try to make sense of what that opportunity set is ahead of us. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. That's a great intro music you've got there.
just want to get everybody's attention to start off there, you know what I mean? All right, before we get started, I got a few questions for you so the listeners can get to know you a little better. Cool?
Sure.
All right. Jonathan, what was the first concert you ever went to?
I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and they used to have something called the World Series of Rock, which was an all-day event where they brought in a bunch of headline acts, probably... I don't know if it was the first, but one of the first I ever went to was Bob Seger was the headline, the Jay Giles Band, Eddie Money, Def Leppard. I think that was the
That sounds amazing. That sounds amazing. All right, next question: beach or mountains? Now, this is a year-round commitment, not seasonal. Where would you rather be?
Well, that's too bad because I literally just came back from skiing with my son in Utah. But I think the answer. I think the answer to that year round would have to be beach.
Yeah, I'm with you. Just saw snow on the beach last month, and it was pretty fantastic.
Welcome to climate change.
Yeah. Have you been to more states or more countries?
Probably about the same number of both, I would guess.
Nice. Still some work to do, I guess, on either side. If you haven't been to 50, right, you can still make a couple more. This is a new one for listeners who are tuning in. Who do you admire most?
Well, I don't know about most, but professionally, I have been influenced. I was influenced at the beginning of sort of my career in this area by Al Gore's work, you know, around climate change. He began holding congressional hearings back in the 70s as I was just sort of coming up and beginning to pay attention to things. And I've been interested in the environment myself just personally for a long time. So he's the first person that pops in my head as somebody who influenced some of the decisions I made in my career.
Yeah, there's, you know, is those people that were impactful and, you know, sort of maybe guiding the path you've gone down. Cool. All right. Yeah. Now, this is the most important question. What is the best sandwich?
Oh, finally, an easy question. Pastrami and Swiss on rye with heavy Russian dressing.
Oof. I can't argue with that. That is an excellent sandwich. All right. That was great. Thank you very much. All right. So maybe now just tell us a little bit quickly about how you got to where you are today beyond, you know, my little intro in the beginning there.
Well, as I mentioned, I was always interested in the environment. I worked at a nature center when I was, you know, a kid in high school. After I got out of college, after I got out of college, I had a couple of jobs that showed me what I didn't want to do, which was also helpful. But the first job that I had that I liked, I worked for McKinsey and Company, which was a big management consulting firm. And then I ran a couple companies for a while, and I ended up in the investing space. I was a partner in, and then the COO of Tiger Management. It was a big hedge fund. But I've always been interested in both the public sector and the private sector. And so when I was asked to become a political appointee and become the senior policy advisor at the Commerce Department, I agreed to do that. The guy I worked for, who was Secretary of Commerce, a very fabulous guy, died in a plane crash on a trade mission. And I ended up moving over to Department of the Interior under Bruce Babbitt as his senior policy advisor. So from there, I was doing both of those things. I launched, for personal reasons, I ended up staying in Washington, D.C., as opposed to going back to New York. I started a venture capital firm, which was not focused particularly around this area, around these topics, but worked on companies in this area. And because this area is filled with defense contractors and others, as it happens, I did a fair amount of work in advanced battery technology, and surprisingly, in early solar technology for the military. That led me to being asked to run the LPO, the loan program at Department of Energy, when the Obama administration came in. And then after that, I started an RIA called Tax Equity Advisors to help big companies take advantage of the tax program, tax credit programs out there. Ended up working at Guggenheim for a while, and I've been at Apollo as the chair of our sustainability-related investing activity on the equity side for the last 3 years or so.
Quite a journey, and I love this idea of the importance of a public-private partnership, and we'll definitely touch on that as we get going. But I think that that's something that we're apt to see more of in the coming years, for sure. So, all right, why don't we get started with the current narrative in the energy sector? AI, data centers, power demand, growth, they seem to have taken over the narrative from like everything. Well, maybe like until the last 52 days. but then there are a lot of people who argue now today that the energy transition, a term that can mean decarbonization of the economy or whatever it is, whatever energy transition means, I guess, is still a work in progress, that it's over. But is the energy transition over? Are we calling it the wrong thing? How should we be thinking about, this point in the energy economy?
Well, those are good questions. Let me try to tackle them sort of one at a time as I heard them. Is AI taking over? So I just got back yesterday from a couple of days at CERAWeek, which is the big energy conference that they hold annually in Houston. And I would say that a huge amount of the conversation was about AI. How you build it, how you power it, where the power comes from. So to a certain extent, the answer is yes, AI is taking over. But that would be a little glib because, of course, there's lots of growing power demands, EV charging and all kinds of things. And there's a fair amount of progress being made on reducing the amount of power that the hyperscale data centers will require. Now, that's not all happening right away, and it'll take, an extended period of time. But yeah, I do think we're going to be talking about power demands for AI-related data centers for, for a long time to come. And the word, of course, that people are using is addition, right, as opposed to transition now. And they're also changing, I guess I'd say, they're also changing the vocabulary, right? So we're talking a lot more about energy security and resilience, et cetera. Is the energy transition over? I would say definitely not. Not only not, but growing, right? Most of the new nameplate capacity that's came on last year and in the last couple of years has been renewables related. Most of what's in the queue is transition related, if you will. These are the fastest growing sectors, with big job multipliers. So I would say that the energy transition is alive and well, provided you look through an aperture that's wide enough to focus on, states rather than just the federal government, other countries rather than the US, et cetera. I think we're headed backwards a little bit here on that topic. But to me, it's a little like, the energy transition train has left the station. You can slow the train down. You can maybe even bring it temporarily to a stop, but trains don't go backwards. So it will be more a question of how long it takes to ramp back up than anything else, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen a lot of the similar things in the data. I had been talking recently about how a couple of weeks ago in ERCOT, 5 gigawatts of power was dispatched at peak time at the expense of natural gas. And to your point, in terms of what's in the queue, battery capacity is going to double in ERCOT in the next year. So we'll continue to see some of that. But at the same time, this power demand growth thesis is loud and clear. And to your comment about CERAWeek, it just seemed like power and gas. That's all anybody really wanted to talk about. And so when you do you think that the tech companies who are desiring this power for AI, can it only come from gas and maybe nuclear down the road? This 24/7, you know, reliable power. How do we see that evolving a little bit?
You know, it's funny. I hear people say that a lot, that, you know, it's got to come from nukes and this and that and the other thing. I think almost by definition, the power requirement, the power demands for these hyperscalers will come from all three general buckets: renewables, gas, and nuclear, because of the timeframes required to get these things up. I'm always puzzled when people say nukes, because whether we don't even have commercially viable SMRs in the market yet, right? So right. Whether it takes 5 years or 10 years, or pick out some number you want, before nuclear power is available at scale to power these things, that's far too long if you care about who's going to win the AI race, right?
Sure.
So let's say nukes play an important role, but somewhere out there, it still takes 18 months, 24 months, and that depends on what's available in the supply chain to build a combined cycle plant, right? To build a gas plant. I mean, so that's out there. You've got renewables that are essentially ready to go now or can be instantly built on site. They have certain features that make them not the perfect fit for large-scale power demands for hyperscalers over a long period of time. But my point is, I think you'll see one segue into the other, segue into the next.
I see.
I don't think it's one or the other.
So that to that energy addition theme, I guess, is what you're sort
yeah, of... and it, the conversation about whether it's gas or nukes seems to come at this conversation from the supply side. If you're coming at it from the public policy side of the United States wants to win the AI war, you've got to be able to provide big, massive amounts of power today, right?
Right.
Even as you're building out the new data centers and their power sources.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You mentioned earlier in the career you had invested or spent a lot of time on battery technology or early battery technology. From then to now, and then from now to some point in the future, do you see that storage time improving drastically or enough that it becomes a better fit for some of these data center needs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, look, when we all started, you know, back in the day, and there really wasn't any battery storage at all.
There was Duracell, you know, Energizer you had.
And then we got to kind of, you know, we got to 1 hour time, then we got to 4 hour time, then we got to 8 and 12 hour time. You know, some of the other technologies, molten salt, for example, aluminum shavings and things probably take you to 13 to 15 hour times, depending on size and scale and volume. But with, you know, what's coming around the bend, of course, in the form of solid state, you know, long duration batteries take you a lot closer than that to permanence. And then somewhere out in the, it always seems like it's 5 years away, but somewhere out there in the distance are perovskites, right? And other kinds of things that, you know, probably solve the problem. I don't see many people actually selling even residential solar these days without storage associated with it, and certainly not at the commercial scale.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's maybe an underappreciated part of the addition is the battery and the potential for battery storage over time, and something that we're certainly keeping a very close look at, close eye on. And so, you mentioned earlier that a touch of the narrative shift away from environment or more towards energy security and energy affordability. And, you know, is this the new reality? do you have any thoughts around the narrative shift, and has it actually shifted, or have things just become louder in one area and more quiet in the other?
That's an interesting question, because I think the answer is both. The first answer is that all we've really been doing is substituting the words energy security and resilience for, you know, ESG, greening, affordability, et cetera, partly because that shift actually takes time.
Right.
And so the vocabulary has changed before anything on the ground has changed.
Right.
I do think that energy security is actually somewhat different than clean energy for the purposes of environmental protection and climate change.
Sure.
And it does put a premium on making the most of what you have available. We have an enormous amount of fossil fuels available to us. So to my mind, the challenge is, how do you keep those green? How do you keep those as clean as possible while you ensure energy security on your way to clean energy security? Those two things are not in opposition in my mind, but they are iterative.
Right. And I see what you're saying. So you stay, you know, stay clean, leveraging the resources that you have now to the extent that you can as you move forward and technology improves and you're able to install the clean energy or however it is.
Well, I'll give you an example. You know, way back when I was running the loan program at the Department of Energy, I suggested that because scrubber systems for coal plants were so expensive for medium-sized, facilities, that actually what we do is I buy a bunch of scrubber systems and create leasing programs for them. For a variety of reasons, that didn't happen. But my only point is that there are solutions out there that allow you to use more traditional and voluminous energy sources in a cleaner fashion, while you're making this long-term transition to totally clean. And one of the things that I think has gotten us sideways is that this somehow became ideological, right? And as I said to you the other day on something, you know, electrons don't have political points of view, right? They don't have ideology.
Yeah.
They're just electrons. And so the question is not like, is it a good electron or is it a bad electron? It's a, how do we keep all the electrons that we need generating while making that generation process as clean as possible? So the thing I really don't understand is the Trump administration's instant negative response to clean power, not because it is or isn't a thing, but because it exists and it does provide power, and it's clear that it can produce power, at least certain kinds of the solar and utility scale solar and wind, you know, essentially at cost parity. So why we wouldn't want to use literally all of the above, I don't understand.
Yeah, we'll see how that sort of plays out. But, you know, the headline they want on the energy side is energy dominance, right? Or American energy dominance. And so as you draw on your experience at the LPO, in what I can only describe as uncertainty on this family-friendly podcast in Washington today, how are you thinking the best way to scale large energy infrastructure in America? Like, is it the public-private partnership? Is it incentives from the government for the private sector to do it? How should we think about American energy dominance?
Well, first, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. You know, how do we best scale, you know, energy infrastructure in the United States? Everybody knows the answer to that question. It's just a question that we don't do it, right? We need to expand renewable energy capacity. We need to increase storage. We need to modernize and upgrade the grid. We need to implement more robustly sort of smart grid technology to improve efficiency, reliability. We need to streamline permitting. We need to align federal and state policy, particularly around new transmission. We could use insurance products to spread the risk. It's kind of a known recipe, right?
Right.
It's just that, you know, the policy around here has gotten complicated. And if you don't do those things sequentially in the order in which they need to happen, you suboptimize. Now, I will say one other thing, though, and that is that everything I just said is true, but it depends to a certain extent on interest rates, tariffs, boycotts, and other kinds of things, whether or not these things, you know, actually get done. But I think scaling the energy infrastructure in the United States is not a difficult intellectual challenge. It's not even a difficult financial challenge. There's plenty of capital to do all these things. There just needs to be a mutual agreement by policymakers that this is what they want to do. The CEO of Chevron spoke at CERAWeek yesterday, I think, before, I can't remember which one, and said, look, basically the thing we care most about is certainty, is continuity, right? We can't keep jumping. He was talking about jumping, you know, week to week, but I don't even think we can jump administration to administration without, you know, sub-optimizing what we're doing here.
Right. So it's like, how do I make a 10-year nuclear investment if I have no idea what the federal government's going to look like in 4 years, let alone maybe 2 years, how things are going to change? And so there has to be that, I guess, I mean, I sort of wrote down all of the things that you were saying, and it sticks out to me that like regulatory and permitting reform is key, and then somehow letting states and the federal government work better together. I mean, the ISO system is good in many ways, other challenges. Like, do you see anything on the horizon that will allow for that? We'll just call it permitting reform or ability to collaborate better?
Is one of the few places there is actually agreement on both sides of the aisle. I would be very surprised if we didn't get permitting reform done. And in fact, as I'm sure, as you well know, there was a robust effort to get permitting reform done, you know, last year. There's a bill in place that had bipartisan support for it. Whether that happens in this new context or not, I don't know, but it certainly seems like it ought to.
And in that bill that you're describing, that was Manchin's thing, right? Would that have allowed, I'm not as familiar as I should be with it, would that have allowed for some of the things that you were mentioning to be fast-tracked in terms of, you know, improving the grid and working on?
Yes and no. It was, the Manchin bill was really more around the internal government processes like NEPA reviews and reform.
Oh, okay.
And other kinds of things, but it did touch on and identify, you know, a number of those areas. Permitting reform is critical to getting this done. I mean, you know, the SunZia project, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but a big wind company called Pattern Energy built essentially a transmission system across a half a dozen states, in order to get it. And the project took like 15 years.
Okay.
Just now, each state to, you know,
to approve. Oh, I see what you're saying. And so that it can't take 15 years is what you're saying.
Right. So we've got to get alignment at the federal and state level. The model for this is very clear, and we all use it every day. It's the National Highway System, right? The National Highway System was laid out in the Eisenhower administration essentially to facilitate the move of defensive capabilities around the United States, right?
Right. Every five miles has to be one straight mile. You know why? So if you had to land a plane on it, you could.
Oh, is that right? That I didn't know.
How cool is that?
Yeah, that's awesome. there's a model for this stuff, you know?
Right. No, for sure. So I guess what do you see as the biggest challenge in bridging the gap between public and private financing? Like, in order to achieve some of these goals that we're talking about? Because I know when I talk to a lot of the private investors, they're worried about the time frame, like you said, the changing administration, or they're worried about either some kind of technology risk or cost overrun risk or something that would be out of their control. And so they're the private capital is still sitting on the sides in some of these projects that they might otherwise be very comfortable putting capital into. So where's that challenge to bridge that gap?
Well, you know, public-private partnerships are kind of a relatively new term for something that's been going on for a very long time, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, like, the government has lots of national labs. We do lots of pure research. We do lots of applied research. Fracking is a perfect example of a technology that is the result of a 20-year collaboration between the federal government and one company in particular, but several companies working mm-hmm. on these technologies. At the other end, you know, we've got grants and then tax credit program incentives and one kind of thing or another. What we were missing in the middle for a while was support for pilot and demonstration projects. That actually was introduced during the Biden administration. I'm hopeful that the new Secretary of Energy will see fit to keep that, because that creates that whole continuum from bench to commercialization. And I'll also go further and say, I don't really think we can get to where we're trying to go collectively, no matter what your point of view is, without the public sector's active participation in this, for exactly the reason you noted, which is nobody wants to do a first of a kind, right?
Right.
So that's clearly a public good. That's clearly a public function. It is a legitimate debate to talk about how you don't pick winners and losers. I think that's complicated and never resolvable, but resolvable administration to administration, still mm-hmm. within the logical band of we want to support innovative technologies. The way I think about those technologies is as a traditional technology S-curve, right? Which yeah. is that the government piece you're asking about begins at early commercialization. So when I was running, you know, the federal government's innovation capital, right, we were still yeah. at the stage of utilities had to prove out utility scale solar, utility scale wind, et cetera. We don't need the government to do that anymore. It's a very mature industry, and the government doesn't do it anymore, right? What's right. coming up the next part of the curve? You know, hydrogen, some parts of green hydrogen, I don't know.
Yeah.
You determine whatever the curve is yourself, but whenever you get to some technology that's just at pre-commercial, early commercialization, that is, I think, a role for the federal government.
So are there any missing pieces right now in the government-backed loan programs being able to create bankable energy projects? Or is it a pretty...
One of the best ways for the government to do it, and I think it's not going to be very robust for the next few years, is for the government to use its heft, its scale, to make you know, purchases of various kinds. I'll give you a simple example. The government, you know, could buy electric vehicles for the Postal Service, right? And use that scale to drive changes in the EV marketplace, or could have been the EV marketplace. So yeah, I mean, there is a role now. I think if we're gonna skinny everything way, 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 way back, the likelihood of that happening is not as high. The other thing the government can and should do and does in lots of different industries is to provide insurance programs, right? And we have lots and lots of experience in you know, crop insurance. I mean, we have insurance programs everywhere. So that's another place the government
could backstop. Yeah, so you're to sort of backstop some of these investments to give people a little more security. Yeah. Well, yeah. Right. I mean, I think we probably hopefully we'll see some of those coming in the near term to continue to push forward the energy agenda.
At the state and some federal, I mean, the whole green bond effort is really a government participation element, if you will.
Right. Well, before we finish up, I'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about AI and energy and, you know, through, you know, CERAWeek and what's come out of it and what, you know, just what I hear from different clients and the questions that I get asked. I describe the AI and energy situation as feeling kind of shaley, like 2011 shale, when people were running around thinking they knew everything that was going on, but they actually didn't. And so, you know, having an understanding about, you know, how much power demand is actually going to do, what's the impact actually going to be from AI, and, you know, how could we make money in this process? So a couple of questions there. One would be, you know, what role do you see AI playing in energy demand and decarbonization? And then I'll come back to the other ones. So not to overwhelm you there.
I think AI has a huge role to play. I think it has a role to play across all sources of power, in terms of discovery, drilling efficiencies, yield off solar panels, you know, as they're designed, wind turbine, you know, and blade design, transmission line regulation and voltage security, right across the board. I think it's going to have a huge impact.
Yeah, I agree. You know, time will tell. But I guess from where you sit today at Apollo, what would you say are some of the most promising or early stage achievements that you've seen to date, and where do you think the best place is to make money today in energy and climate?
Well, I think, if I understood your question right, I think the most, among some of the promising early stage things now are, I'd be looking at ocean current technology, run of river technologies, low pressure geothermal, green hydrogen, which I still think is going to be legit longer
term. We can agree to disagree on green hydrogen, but that's okay.
Fair enough. That's what makes markets. Longer term, I think I touched earlier on perovskites, you know, which I think are going to look, we should be doing offshore wind right now. It's not, I wouldn't call that a new technology, but for the United States, it will be new and meaningful. Yeah. Best place to make money. Well, on the public security side, you know, frankly, the answer is all these clean power companies and tech companies are, stocks are all going to be beaten down to, you know, beaten to a pulp. But I don't think the best ones are going away at all. On the private side, maybe more interesting, you know, I'm interested and we're interested in circular economy plays. We're interested in emerging markets. I would say that for me, the next big trend, the next big place I'd like to see us focus is on water.
Okay. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, the world is awash in water, but it's filled with salt. Right. And so there's very little fresh water around the world. In fact, 98% of the water in the world is salt or brine. 2 to 3% is fresh water. We've got, you know, a burgeoning global population. We've got a population that not only is growing, but will require and is entitled to power of various kinds. For that, we need cooling, we need water, we need drinking water, we need all kinds of things. So I think that water is a major part of actually everything, including the power sector.
And don't forget how much water you need to cool those chips in the data centers, right?
Absolutely. Well, and you're seeing new technology. You're seeing floating data centers, floating solar arrays, you know, all kinds of things, trying to figure out how to use water efficiently. You're seeing water, cool, interesting technologies in smart ag. We've begun playing around with cloud seeding and trying to create water. So yeah. I think you're going to see a lot more conversation about water in the next few years.
That's interesting, because water has been a topic in the traditional energy space, you know, for the last two decades, as plenty of it is used in the shale revolution, right? So definitely something that I think we should all keep on our radar. Well, look, we're a little over time because this conversation has been fantastic, and I want to thank you again for joining us to talk about, you know, how you're seeing the energy economy. It's there's a lot going on, and gotta try and keep it straight and keep marching towards an energy future that works for us all. So Jonathan, thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it. Take care.
And to everyone else, join me next week or next month on Next Morning Energy Live, where my guest will be, I'm not sure who yet. And then in May, join us May 12th to the 15th at our Evolve conference in Houston. Let me know if you need any details. Take care, everyone. All right.